tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Karl Marx, how you doing, man?
Yahoo! I am good, I'm good. I just need a little trim.
Okay, hey, no problem. Keep it over the ears, huh?
Yeah, that is right. I want to keep the lion effect. But kind of wind blow, too, you know? I got a photo shoot. How's business, huh, Bubba?
Well, I want to thank you for sending all your socialist buddies on in here.
Yeah, well, I was thinking of trying some jab. What do you think, Bubba?
Want to learn more about the Marxist agenda and other important stuff? Listen to The Ultimate Remedy with L.B. Bork, Tuesdays, 6 p.m. Eastern, right here on Revolution Radio.
Hoor jy die machtige trene? Oor die veld kom dit wyd gesweer. Van een volkse ontwaking, wat harte dat sidder en beer.
Ek smoeg vir die vrese waarmee ons moet leven, vir gans en vir moord en vir ryp. Ek smoeg vir die bad news, vir Zuma en sy views, van ons op TV moet kyk. Ek wil nie meer hoor hoe ons tieners begrawe, oor niemand hul steur aan die wet. Ek wil nie meer lees van affirmative action, of beklei om te hou wat ek het. Gee vir my een nieuwe geit, koos toe plesie en een tellerij, wat liedjie sing en skryf en stry, oor die mooi van ons land en ons reg om hier te kan bly. Ek soek vir Malema, sy leens en sy sê maar, ons hou maar ons mond en betaal. Ons kruip weg in kampe, word blind vir die rampe, en bid dat die Heer ons omhaal. Daar's Winnie Mandela, wat mense verbrand het, maar nou wil sy huil in haar hand. Die staatskas is leeg en die ANC jeug saai verwoesting en pijn hier ons land. Gee vir my een nieuwe gij, een koos toe plesie en een tellerij, wat liedjie sing en skryf en stry, oor die mooi van ons land en ons reg om hier te kan bly. Vir die grond waar sy kinders kan bly, maar sy huis en sy lande is nou in die hande van die vijand teen wie hy moes stry. Ons kinders verstaan nie waar kom al vandaan nie, al erfenis is uitgewis. Geen volkslied of vlag nie en geen erewag nie vir die helde wat daar nie meer is. alles sien ek tellerij, wat liedjie sing en skryf en stry, oor die mooi van ons land en ons reg om hier te kan bly. Gee vir my een nieuwigheid, een koos toe plesien ek tellerij, wat liedjie sing en skryf en stry, oor die mooi van ons land en ons reg om hier te kan bly, en ons reg om hier te kan bly.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, it's Dr. Merwe. You're listening to Radio Free South Africa on Freedom Slips Revolution Radio. And our esteemed guest tonight, return guest, one of our good friends, is Dr. Peter Hammond from Frontline Fellowship. Peter, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, Scott. Good to see you.
Tremendous, tremendous. Peter, yes, we had a very interesting week past, but also a very interesting month, a couple of months in South Africa. You're in South Africa, I'm in South Africa at this point. Yeah, let's speak about this weekend and specifically Mandela Day. I know you did a piece recently relating to Mandela, because in South Africa we actually have a day to celebrate this person. To the outside world, he's a very good guy. To us, he's maybe not such a good guy, because we're sitting with the legacy of his time. Hello, Peter, you there?
I am here, indeed.
Excellent. Did you hear my question, Peter?
I did. It just sounded like then I heard the ocean coming, and it sounded like some waves, and I thought maybe something was going in there. Yes, according to United Nations Resolution, 18 July is meant to be Nelson Mandela International Day. And they do this to say, in recognition of the former South African president's contribution to the culture of peace and freedom. They said they recognize Nelson Mandela's values and his dedication to the service of humanity in the fields of conflict resolution, race relations, the promotion and protection of human rights, reconciliation, gender equality, rights of children and other vulnerable groups, as well as upliftment of the poor and undeveloped community. It acknowledges his contribution to the struggle for democracy internationally and the promotion of a culture of peace throughout the world. So, unbelievable. You've got songs of praise and hymns glorifying Nelson Mandela in choirs and taught to school children. This is really, I believe, the beginning of a new religion. This is like the ancient pharaohs being worshipped as gods, like the chairman of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And it's absolutely outrageous, because when you think of what Nelson Mandela did, he, for example, legalized abortion. I mean, what about the poor and vulnerable there? We've had 1.7 million South Africans killed by abortion legally with taxpayers' money since Mandela legalized abortion 1st of February 1997. And as far as protection of the rights of vulnerable groups, he legalized pornography. And the Child Protection Unit, South African Police Services, reports child rape increased over 400% as a result of his legalization of pornography. As far as contributing to the struggle for human rights and democracy and peace worldwide, he closed down South Africa's embassy in the Republic of China, Free China, on the island of Taiwan. He opened up South Africa's embassy in Communist China, Red China, one-party dictatorship with the most brutal human rights record, where they're crushing churches and Christians right now. He welcomed to South Africa the longest reigning dictator in the world at that time, Fidel Castro, gave him the highest award this country can offer, assembled both houses of parliament for Fidel Castro to address, which is a very rare privilege. And Mandela, as president, uncritically supported some of the worst dictatorships on the planet, like Castro's Cuba and communist China and all of that. So the General Assembly resolution speak of Nelson Mandela's dedication to the service of humanity, gender equality, is absolute nonsense, because under him, prostitution was effectively legalized, pornography was legalized, abortion was legalized, instance of rape exploded. Sex shops were opened for the first time in the country. Blasphemy was legalized. And not only that, when you look at what Nelson Mandela actually did in this country in terms of crime, he opened prison doors and put over 100,000 prisoners on the street, including murderers. And many of them were committing crimes within a short while. Some even were murdering within 24 hours of being released. And so the recidivism rate of people he released was calculated 97%. That means committing the same crime. So honestly, it's extraordinary how you can have people around the world, and in South Africa even, singing his praises and acting like he's some kind of model of example. In fact, I had an ANC person said to me, what Jesus Christ is to you, Nelson Mandela is to us.
Exactly. He's a literal icon. He's worshipped, not only in South Africa, he's worshipped worldwide, not only by black people, by people from all races, because of the narrative, the lie that was created around the person of Nelson Mandela. The 27 years sitting in jail as a so-called political prisoner, and I want to come back to that in a moment, and the whole narrative around that. Free Mandela was basically the cry of the left throughout the 1980s and even in the 1970s. But we know we are not dealing with a saint here. He was not a political prisoner. He was a prisoner because he committed crimes. Is that not true, Peter?
That is true. In fact, you don't have to take our word for it. You can take the Amnesty International. Amnesty International never took his case. Amnesty International refused to ever deal with him because they said he had his fair trial. He was not a political prisoner. He had committed various crimes, violent crimes. He had a fair trial and he had a very reasonable sentence. And I'm quoting straight from the Amnesty International reason as to why they didn't take up his case. And so even the Rand Daily Mail, which is the most outspoken liberal leftist newspaper in South Africa at the time of the Rivonia trial, and in many ways a supporter of Mandela and ANC, even the Rand Daily Mail editorial wrote about the sentences passed by the judge. The sentences passed by Judge De Wet at the close of the Rivonia trial are both wise and just. The law is best served when there's firmness tinged with mercy. And this was the case yesterday. The sentences could not have been less severe than those imposed. The men found guilty of planned sabotage on a wide scale that conspired for armed revolution. As the judge pointed out yesterday, the crime of which they were guilty was really high treason, and the death penalty would have been justified. So that's what the Rand Daily Mail, as leftist as it comes, said. And all over the world, there were praises for the court sentence of Mandela getting only a life sentence, because if he had been convicted of those crimes anywhere in Africa, he would have been hung. If he had been convicted of those crimes in 1964 in America, he would have been electrocuted. In Britain, he would have been hung. In France, he would have been guillotined. There was not a country in the world where those crimes, which included bomb blasts going off, for example, in Johannesburg Station, where this grandmother of 84 was incinerated and her young granddaughter was scarred for life with a petrol bomb in a briefcase, and these sort of things. So when people have this, Mandela was a political prisoner, a prisoner of conscience, locked up just because he opposed apartheid, just because he's black. Well, that's fiction. That's absolute imagination. It's got no relationship to reality. Nelson Mandela was a Marxist. He was a revolutionary. He was trained by Che Guevara and the Cuban DGI. He was trained in Algeria and Ethiopia in terrorism. He was involved. He wasn't just involved. He was the founder of Umkhonto we Sizwe, the terrorist arm of the ANC, which, by the way, the ANC leadership at that time did not support. I think Letuli was the head of the ANC then, and the ANC executive expressly forbade having a violent armed struggle, as he called it. But Nelson Mandela, as it turned out after he died, was always a senior member of the South African Communist Party Politburo. And Mandela even admits in his book, Long Walk to Freedom, that without the support of the ANC leadership, he launched the armed struggle and Umkhonto we Sizwe. And plainly, he did it in obedience to the Communist Party, not in obedience to the ANC. It's funny that now the ANC has adopted it as though it was a good thing, because at the time, it was not accepted, and even the president of the ANC at that time, Albert Luthuli, condemned it. So don't let facts get in the way of a good story, though. They're trying to portray Mandela now as some peaceful Gandhi, whereas actually he was a violent terrorist revolutionary who didn't mind how many people's bodies were burned, broken, or blown up. For him, the whole goal was a communist revolution. And in fact, one of the uncontested evidences entered into the Rivonia trial was a handwritten document over 60-something pages, How to Be a Good Communist, written by Nelson Mandela. And Mandela was trained as a lawyer, so he understood what pleading guilty is. He accepted, yes, I did this, and yes, he didn't question that that was his document in his handwriting, and he didn't even deny the over 160-odd cases of public violence which he was charged with. So in no way can Nelson Mandela be construed as a prisoner of conscience or political prisoner. He's not like Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who wrote a poem or a letter critical of the government. It's this is someone who blew people up.
Yes, a violent criminal. And there's a reason why I started off with the legacy of apartheid. Because throughout this man's life, he started off as a lawyer, but then very quickly after that, and we can even go to the people where he did his articles as an attorney, and where they fit into the so-called struggle and the communist link to them. But even from there on, he was never a good guy. If we can call it like that. He was always busying himself with things like planting bombs, creating an armed unit to so-called fight, but it was terrorism against the so-called apartheid regime, the Nationalist Party government, throughout his life. And it actually remained as such during his presidency. I read certain articles this week that really shocked me to my system, that people today still do not even have the faintest idea of who the man was, and he's simply portrayed as this saint. The past Saturday, white people in South Africa, now white people in South Africa are really under threat at this point in time. We are really under threat. And even white people would still then celebrate his birthday. And the 67 minutes given as a gesture of goodwill, even to this man. These things are really mind-boggling to me, Peter. Why is this? Why are people not informed? Is it because of mainstream media? What is the psychology behind this whole thing?
It's a good question, because, you know, I was summoned to the president's mansion when Nelson Mandela was president, and I just marched 30,000 people to parliament to protest his secularization policies, where he is legalizing pornography, perversion, abortion, and I marched to the gates of parliament, protested, and one of his people from the president's office came out and issued me a summons to come to president's house 2 days from then. So we marched on Tuesday, and Thursday I went to meet Mandela, and, you know, he is very charismatic. He is very charming. He was suave. He was smooth. He is obviously very comfortable with dealing with press and dealing with people on a diplomatic basis. He shook my hand warmly. He told me he is always open to my concerns and responsive to the concerns of my constituency, and his door was always open. And, you know, Mandela was a politician, and he should be a charming man. But I found that the only way to deal with a person like that is to be straight. And so the first question Nelson Mandela asked me was, "So, Mr. Hammond, what were you doing during the years of struggle?" And I responded, "I was fighting people like you, sir." And he laughed and he slapped his knee and he stood up from the sofa, came over and shook my hand again. And he said, "I am so glad to meet an honest white man." He said, "Every white I've met has always said that he always opposed apartheid and always supported me. I wondered how the National Party stayed in power for 40 years when all the whites supported me and not the National Party." So I responded, "Well, Mr. Mandela, you may be sure we were not fighting for apartheid. We were fighting against communism and against terrorism." And the thing is, Mandela, I think many people have in this country, I'm talking about a lot of our white friends and neighbors, have been guilt manipulated, and they feel that they've got to apologize for what we did. And yet they're forgetting the context. The context was we were in the middle of the Cold War, and South Africa was facing the brunt of the Soviet Union's thrust southwards, seeking to gain control of the strategic minerals and the Cape Sea route. And the Soviets and the Cubans were in Angola. Our forces were fighting them straight on. This is the context. Communists had taken Mozambique. They took Zimbabwe. They took Angola. They were in all the frontline states. There were Soviet submarines and warships around our shores. There were MiGs in Maputo and in Luanda and Huambo. And we were facing a clear and present danger. We had car bombs in our streets. We had limpet mines and shops. We had all forms of terrorism, including assassinations, taking place in our country. And the Marxists were really going to try and run our country into the ground. They were promoting everything from international sanctions, economic warfare, sports boycotts, psychological warfare, and terrorism. Terrorism, landmines in farm roads, and killing people, kidnapping people, murdering. That was the context. So I see no reason to apologize for having fought against communism. And when Mr. Mandela said to me, apartheid was the greatest evil in the history of the world, I responded, I cannot agree with you, Mr. President. That prize belongs for your friends, your supporters, the communists. And I said, the greatest threat to life in all of history has been communist secular humanist states. 160 million people were killed in the 20th century alone just at the hands of Marxist governments. And as he was still staring at me impassively, I started to specify. I said, that includes the 66 million killed in the Soviet Union, of which 36 million were killed by Joseph Stalin's regime. That includes the over 68 million murdered under Mao Zedong in Red China. And he was still silent, so I carried on. I spoke about the millions killed in Cambodia by the Khmer Rouge in Vietnam and in Laos. And I moved to Ethiopia with Mengistu, who I knew was his personal friend, and who was living in South Africa under protection at that moment. And I went on to Mozambique and Angola and ended with his personal pal, Fidel Castro. He had just hosted, speaking in joint sessions in our parliaments in Cape Town, to joint sessions, having Fidel Castro speak there. And I spoke about all the death tolls under Fidel Castro. And I said, we're not talking about people killed in battle. We're not talking about enemies and foreigners and foreign armies. We mean citizens killed by their own governments in peacetime. 160 million people in communist countries in the 20th century so far. And, that's the only way you can deal with Marxists. You tell them the truth. You've got to be straightforward. The truth does not fear investigation. But unfortunately, most South Africans have accepted the guilt manipulation and the twisted narratives, and they've worshipped now before the altar of this multiculturalism and this new idol, this Mandela mania. And in many cases, what you find is people apologizing for trying to protect our families from the terrible things that are happening right now: the legalization of abortion, pornography, the violence, the crime, the rape, the home invasions, the destruction of our monuments, the brainwashing of children to schools with Marxist evolutionary situation ethics, this comprehensive sexuality education, the CSE, where they're basically putting a pornographic culture into the schools, even primary schools, to teach the children how to be whoremongering, fornicating perverts. This is what we were fighting against. And at one point, I was actually in Parliament, in the South African Parliament, giving a submission before the Publications Control Board. This is 1996. They were still drafting the legislation. So there's about 50 members of Parliament in the subcommittee. And I'd given my submission. And one of the individuals there, an ANC member of Parliament sitting on the other side facing me, he said to me, have you apologized for what you did in the Southern Defence Force? And I said, you want me to apologize for what I did in the Southern Defence Force? And he said, yes. I said, I am sorry that we didn't kill all of you. You were not freedom fighters, you were terrorists. You did not attack our military bases, you attacked civilians. Black civilians. You burned 1,000 black South Africans with a brutal necklace murder. You planted landmines in dirt roads. You killed whole families. You planted landmines in roads leading to schools. You killed school children coming in school buses on the way to school. You kidnapped young children from schools and took them across the border to brutalize them and train them for your terrorist groups. You murdered many and you raped the girls. You threw hand grenades through windows into black policemen's homes at night, killing sometimes their children in the cot. You petrol bombed the homes of black town councillors. Car bombs, limpet mines, blatant targeting of civilians. You hypocrites. You speak against racism, then you laugh and you applaud and you give standing ovations to the worst racist in the planet today, Comrade Robert Mugabe, dictator of Zimbabwe. You have no right to ever speak against racism when you so obviously applaud, endorse, and enthusiastically practice it. I'm sorry we ended the war before we thoroughly and completely eradicated every one of you communists. And there was this awkward silence. And then the chairman said, right, let's move to our next point. And they never brought up the subject. That's the only way you can deal with these Marxist bullies, gangsters, thugs, guilt manipulators, because they want you to apologize. Whereas if we just brought up the facts, we have nothing to apologize for except before Almighty God that we ever trusted their word and that we ever compromised and that we ever laid down a rifle, because we trusted them to keep their side of the bargain. And you can see they obviously have no intention of ever having any integrity. They see treaties like pie crust, something made to be broken.
Yes, yes, indeed. And I fully agree with you. There's ways and means to deal with these things. And we've done the wrong thing in the meantime. We've accepted our guilt. And not all of us, but many of us have accepted our guilt. And that being white is somehow evil. And apartheid was this grossly evil system. And slavery in the United States was this grossly horrible system, and everybody was basically bound by it, and all this nonsense, because it's nonsensical arguments that we're dealing with. But it has become part of our thinking, our way of dealing with the present. And this is why I asked the question from you at the start, because I want to bring it now to the current day where we're sitting with a Black Lives Matter movement. Not only in the United States, it's now worldwide, and it's definitely also in South Africa vis-a-vis cricket, rugby, the EFF, even doing the same thing. We see his legacy also, to my understanding, in the Black Lives Matter movement as we see it today. What's your view on this?
Yes, this Black Lives Matter is obviously a Marxist movement, a revolution movement, but it's also a religious cult. And I use the word cult very carefully because it's not just another religion. It's a cult. You see, a religion doesn't always claim to be exclusive, but a cult claims there's no salvation outside their particular corner. So when you look at the social justice revolution, as they call themselves, Black Lives Matter and Antifa, they're changing the focus and the content of the gospel message. They're offering another gospel, a false mission, plainly derived from liberation theology, which is actually nothing more than Marxism wrapped up in religious terminology. It's a battle for hearts, minds, and souls. It's based on black theology, which is also Marxism, just with racism added, along with animism, which depersonalizes evil and sees evil in things and systems rather than personal responsibility. But none of this is biblical theology. Race politics is not biblical. The problem's not skin, it's sin. It's not race, it's grace that's the solution. And those people who kneel to God can stand before any man. We need to fear God, not man. We should obey the Bible, not the mob. And the Bible teaches the total depravity of man, the holiness of God alone, and there's only one way of salvation, that's through Jesus Christ, and salvation comes through his cross, through his sacrifice on the cross of Calvary alone. And yet, what are you seeing with this Black Lives Matter business? You've got a works-based salvation. They want you to mouth certain things. It's almost like what you get in the Roman Empire, where you've got to say, Caesar is Lord. But in fact, what was the earliest confession of the early church? Jesus Christ is Lord. In fact, he's the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. But Black Lives Matter is a direct challenge to the Christian church. It's a new religious cult. They've got a false narrative where they claim that sin is now related to your skin color, and it requires all to repent and kneel before it and chant like a mantra, Black Lives Matter. And they require confessions. They want you to confess to the activists, and they threaten a form of excommunication by shaming you and shunning you if you fail to comply with their demands. And so what you're seeing in Black Lives Matter is a work-based salvation through revolution. And there's no atonement, but blood is shed. Windows are smashed. Shops are looted. Monuments are defaced and desecrated, defiled, destroyed. In place of Christ, they're offering a false Messiah, BLM martyrs, BLM saints. Now, you may point out, but this saint you're pointing out was a career criminal. He was on drugs. He had violently attacked. Doesn't matter. He's perfect. He's a saint. You mustn't question us. That's heresy. That's treason. And so you see Black Lives Matter organizing public rituals where whites have to get on their knees and wash the feet of these BLM activists. And they then expect to join in the BLM revolutionary agenda in perpetual repentance for perpetual revolution, sort of like Trotskyite. And remember, Leon Trotsky, or Levi Bronstein as his real name is, but Leon Trotsky, the founder of the Red Army, he invented the word racist to be able to stigmatize anyone who opposed Marxism. Because if you were against communism, you're obviously an anti-Semitic racist. So the very term racist is an invention of Leo Trotsky in about 1920. So what they want now is perpetual revolution, perpetual repentance. What is original sin? White, male, straight privilege is original sin. So if you're a white, male, straight, well, three strikes you're out. Now, if you're a black, straight, male, two strikes against you. If you're a white, female, straight, two strikes against you. But you can see the worst of the worst is a white male who's straight. And that's original sin. Now, they've got a law, and it's political correctness. And they've got sacraments, protests, riots, looting, arson. And they're zealously seeking converts, who they're called allies, who must help evangelize by raising awareness. So you can see Black Lives Matter is actually a revolutionary movement, but it's a religious revolutionary movement. And by the way, they don't care about black lives, because you know more than 1,000 black babies are killed by abortion every day just in the United States of America. They don't care about that. They support black abortionists. In fact, they say they're pro-abortion. They supported Gosnell, America's biggest serial killer, and a black man who's killing mostly black children in black communities. Gosnell, Philadelphia's Kermit Gosnell, who is convicted of infanticide, delivering live babies and kill them after birth. They fully supported him. And so if George Floyd had been killed in the womb by abortion before he was born, most of those protesting and rioting in his name would have approved and applauded and would have thought it right to use the taxpayers' money to fund the abortion. So they don't care about the thousands of black lives violently ended by gang violence at the hands of other blacks. They don't care about the blacks in Somalia, Ethiopia, Sudan. The black lives don't matter if they're in the Congo or Nigeria. They don't matter if they're in Soweto either, do they? So this whole Black Lives Matter thing is one colossal fraud, and their agenda is very disturbing. They've declared war on the family. You go on their website, they say, we're committed to disrupting the Western prescribed nuclear family structure. They also say they want to dismantle gender privilege, and they're wanting to promote transgenderism. We are committed to fostering a queer-affirming network. We are wanting to free ourselves from the tight grip of heteronormative thinking. What's that mean? That it's normal to be heterosexual. So they're wanting to promote perversion. And they are wanting to promote not only perversion and pornography and gender confusion and transgenderism, but to destroy the family. And they say quite outright and straight on the website that they are Marxist. So why Christians are bowing to BLM or are supporting them or putting it on their Facebook profiles, it's incredible. The Bible says in Proverbs 25, verse 26, a righteous man falling down in front of the wicked is like a polluted spring and a troubled fountain. And so as Christians, we want nothing to do with BLM. And I would say BLM could stand for Baal, Lucifer, and Moloch. BLM. It's anti-Christian, and I'm shocked and disgusted at how many Christians have fallen for this psychological warfare propaganda campaign.
Yes, it's in its essence, it's not pro-black, it's anti-white. I think that distinction needs to be drawn already. If a person is proud of himself, whether he's a black man or an Asian man or white man, that does not trouble me. I want him to be proud. I want him to honor his roots and who he is and and all those things. It's positive things. But we're not dealing with that yet. It's being portrayed sometimes as that, but we're definitely not dealing with that. And what's so significant for me about Black Lives Matter is exactly what you said. Something as evil as abortion. And we know that black people in the United States at least are very prone to abortion. That for some reason is right in their eyes. In other words, genocide by abortion of their own race is right in their eyes, which tell you that there's a huge hypocrisy inside here. I have my own views on Black Lives Matter as I have the same on COVID and vaccines and all these things and why it's happening. I think in the end, Black Lives Matter is going to eat itself. It's going to kill off itself as a race. Because of what's going on here. If we look at transgenderism, it speaks for itself that if you become queer, so-called queer, you're not going to have an offspring. So in other words, in two or three generations from now, there's not going to be black people if we follow Black Lives Matter's policies to the T and the ideology to the T. So it's very ironic what's going on here. I think they are played. Well, I don't think I know they are played. And it's a very curious game that is indeed being played. Peter?
Yes, you're quite right. Now, I've got a lot of Zulu friends, and they are proud to be Zulus. And they wouldn't use the words like Black Lives Matter. They would say, you know, I'm proud to be a Zulu. And I was brought up amongst the Matabele and Rhodesia, and the Matabele are proud to be Zulu, proud to be Matabele. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's good for people to love their ancestry. But what is the Marxist dialectic? They say, I'm quoting now from the Frankfurt School of Cultural Marxism, we want to break every tie of blood, soil, race, nation, church, family. They want to break all those bonds because what do they want? They want a classless world society of world communism. They don't want families because as goes the family, so goes the nation. They don't want straight father, mother, no, none of this business. They want classless, genderless, characterless, nationless, of course, definitely godless. What they are aiming for, in fact, you can see it. If you just look at the mobs and the violence on the streets, that's what they're wanting. They're trying to bring about a revolution. And we know how revolutions end. Anarchy in the streets leads to tyranny in government. It's so from the French Revolution of 1789, the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, the Chinese Revolution, Mao Zedong and all that. We see it. We see it in Zimbabwe. The anarchy in the streets prepares the way for tyranny in government. And that's the goal. And the other thing is, I don't know how many of these people on the streets realize they've just been lied to. They're being used. They think that they are the forerunners of a more just and equitable order and that they're doing something good and right and noble. And maybe they really believe that, but they are just cannon fodder, expendable cannon fodder for the revolution, and every revolution kills off the revolutionaries right from the beginning. You can look at it from everyone from Saint Just, Robespierre, Danton. They all ended up on the same guillotine that they'd guillotined thousands of others on. And in the Bolshevik Revolution, you can go through the whole list, Bahrain and Beria, heads of the NKVD, leaders, Trotsky, he literally got axed. He was the hero of the revolution, didn't stop him getting axed. They managed to wipe out the entire front echelon of the revolutionaries because, you know, people like the Stalins and Mugabe's out there, they can't trust the revolutionaries on the ground. Even Mugabe, who was the first person he got rid of? Josiah Changarara, the hero of the revolution, to use their term, the head of ZANLA, the military commander of the ZANLA terrorists. And he's obviously going to be the first prime minister of Zimbabwe. So Mugabe killed him. And everybody in Zimbabwe knows that Mugabe in 1979, just before the election, got rid of his primary competitor, who was the hero of the revolution. Josiah Tongarawa was only good for the fighting. Now when it came to the politics, and he was obviously going to be the next one, he gets wiped out. In South Africa, Chris Hani. Well, obviously Chris Hani was going to be deputy to Mandela, and therefore he'd be Mandela's successor. And Winnie Mandela to her dying days, and Bantu Holomisa to this day, he's still alive, maintain that the assassination of Chris Hani was actually an inside job done by the ANC with the knowledge and the connivance of Mbeki and Zuma. And in fact, they would have been nowhere if Chris Hani, who is very charismatic, very well-spoken and a natural leader and a much better speaker and leader actually than Mandela was. And so they got rid of him just prior to the elections in so-called 94. This is the way revolutions work. And if the revolutionaries in the street would realize just how much the leaders who are using them despise them and will get rid of them, because revolutionaries who overthrow one government cannot be trusted by their leaders, because if they knew how to overthrow the last government, they know how to overthrow you. And every Marxist revolution promises things that they can never deliver. And so one of the first priorities they've got is to get rid of the very people who put them there.
Yes, and if you look at all, especially in Southeast Asia, and you will know so much about this, and even in Africa, the first I would call them the pioneers of the revolution, very easily becomes expendable. They become a problem because they know too much. It's as simple as that. They know too much, and then when the second revolution came, they become expendable. They must be killed off. Sent to prison camps, whatever happens to them. So it's very interesting. I would really like to see a little bit further into the future to see what will happen with this first wave of Black Lives Matter, and especially with the white folk joining in, because it seems to me there's a very large contingent of white folk and also Antifa being a white organization being part of this. What will happen to them in future?
Yes. I've had quite a few people comment to me that they've noticed from looking very carefully at the pictures and the videos and so on of the actual demonstrations that it seems that two-thirds of the Black Lives Matter protesters are white, it would seem. And when I've checked this with Americans, I say that's true. There's a lot of meaningless loser whites who are finding some kind of significance in their worthless lives by identifying with this cause and somehow committing cultural suicide, whatever you can call it, because plainly the Black Lives Matter is being run by whites in many cases. And if you just think of the African National Congress, it was plainly hijacked by the Southern Communist Party, and it was KGB Colonel, Lithuanian Jew Joe Slovo, and Ronnie Kashrils, and other who all seem to be predominantly white Jewish people from the Soviet Union, who had the primary move. Interesting, because in the film Mandela Long Walk to Freedom, it's very simple. It's very cut and dried. All the whites are stereotypical cardboard cutout, one-dimensional characters, and they're stupid and they are racist and so on, bigots. And all the blacks are plainly revolutionaries, and they're intelligent and all the rest of it, and brave and bold, and they've got the only intelligent things to say. So Mandela Long Walk to Freedom from doesn't want to confuse people with facts. So you won't see any black policemen, you won't see any colored policemen, you won't see any black prison service or soldiers. It's every policeman in prison service is white. Every prisoner is black. In fact, you don't even see the white or Jewish or Indian co-accused at the Rivonia trial. People being accused are all black. The communists, the good guys by their definition are all black. And the accuser or white and so on. So that obviously isn't the history, but that just makes it so much easier. You know, black, good. White, bad. You know, four legs, good. Two legs, bad. Like George Orwell's Animal Farm.
Exactly, exactly. I love that book. I've read it maybe 20, 30 times. I don't know, because it tells us so much about not animals, but men and how they do things. Yes, we're coming up into the third quarter of our first hour. We have another hour after the change of the hour. It's also significant for me the whole thing of white privilege and white guilt. The two are obviously it's tied together. But there's a reason why we are doing good as a race, if you want to, as a ethnicity, as you want to. Because it's in our culture and our values. There's a reason why the Western world is more advanced than most of the rest of the, barring maybe East Asia, certain parts of China and Japan and so forth. We've earned our spurs, if I can put it like that. We didn't receive anything just simply by virtue of being white. What's your view on this whole noise about white privilege and white guilt a company?
Well, it's a lot of nonsense because if I just think of the fact that I was a member of white privilege, so-called. So my white privilege was getting caned at school, getting conscripted into the army, doing rock PT while the sergeants and corporals stood on my shoulders while I'm doing press-ups and shouted and swore at me and all that and fired machine guns over my head while we're doing obstacle course and crawling under barbed wire in the mud and through concussion grenades, flashbangs, starlights and so on around us, thunder flashes while we're training. And then they put us up in the border where people were trying to kill us. So my white privilege was when I wanted to study at theological college, I had to work 8 hours a night, 6 days a week in the fire brigade to fund my way through theological college. Because even in the heyday of apartheid, so-called, in the early 1980s, I was too pale and I was too male to get any kind of bursary. So the black and the colored students at Baptist Theological College, they all got everything free. And so they didn't have to have outside jobs. Now, the average black or colored student at Baptist Theological Seminary when I was studying was doing four or five subjects a semester. I never did less than 8 subjects a semester, and I even once did 9 subjects in a semester. So I was doing double the amount of studies, and I was doing a full-time job at the same time while doing it. And I'd still have the students coming up to me and saying to me, Peter, could you take my Sunday sermon at this church? I've got an assignment on Monday. Well, I had 2 assignments on Monday, but, you know, sure, I'd always take it. And that's how I went through college. Now, at one point, I looked at this sort of dog's breakfast of an assignment of one of my co-students, and mine was, you know, seriously polished and typed and nicely presented and so on. I went to the principal and said, do we get marked on the same standard here? Principal said, oh, no, no. I said, well, what standard are we marked by? He says, well, I mark you on the percentage of what I think you're capable of, and I mark him on the basis of what I think he's capable of. I said, so a degree from the college isn't exactly equal. He says, no, but you got magna cum laude, you know, because, you know, with the honors. But interesting. Now, I've been in missions now for 38 years, and I've marked a lot of people's assignments in many a college all over Africa. And I've seen students that I failed on important subjects, even after being as seriously generous, even giving marks for things that weren't even in the question, just trying to find anything that I could possibly give a mark for, being super generous, and the person still failed, and yet still see them graduated the next week. And plainly, there isn't an equal stand. So white privilege has been, you get taxed, you get conscripted, you get caned, you have to work through the night for working for study and so on. But the blacks and cults get it free, and they get free medical, and they get free education, they get free housing, and they get subsidized everything else. And they don't get the same tax burden. They don't get conscription. So, you know, this business that you whites were privileged, you the previously advantaged, and the blacks are the previously disadvantaged. No, I think they were previously advantaged, and they presently advantaged, and we were previously disadvantaged, and we're still disadvantaged now. And when people come out with, you know, what you've got now with BBBEE, black, broad-based black economic empowerment, affirmative action, that this is apartheid reversed. Oh, that would be nice. I would love apartheid to be reversed. If only they would do to us what Pavut did to them. Because then if we were getting reverse apartheid, the government would designate vast areas for our exclusive use and ownership. They would designate vast amounts of areas where we would be running ourselves and where others weren't allowed to come by in that area. They'd be building us vast amounts of sports fields and soccer stadiums and hospitals and schools. But we don't want that. We just want to be left alone. We don't want anyone to give us anything for free. But reverse apartheid, wow, that would be paradise for us in South Africa if they would do to us what Favut and co were doing to them. Just think of the independence given, with everything given to Transkei, to Venda, to Bophuthatswana, to Ciskei. Wow, if only we would have reverse apartheid.
Yes, indeed, that's a very valid point that you're making. And B is it's such a destructive system, because if the theoretical part of it could have existed, maybe we could have still seen some good coming from it. But the whole system, the whole legislation has basically been captured by the ANC and its cronies to enrich themselves, to siphon off money. That is what B now actually is, and it was always going to be that. For the very simple reason, that is what communists do. That they use the mechanism of state to enrich themselves at the expense of the populace. Telling the people it's for the people. Black empowerment is black empowerment. It's not. It's crony empowerment for the ANC. And that is why we are seeing literally trillions of rands, not even billions by this time, trillions of rands being siphoned off, stolen, can't be reported on, etc. in South Africa. Peter?
Yes. In fact, according to the African Union Anti-Corruption Task Force, 32% of the GDP, that's 32% of the gross domestic product, a third of the gross domestic product is stolen by government corruption every year. Now, this is not talking about taxation. This is not talking about inflation, which is a hidden tax. It's just talking about corruption. 32% of the GDP is stolen by government corruption. That's the African Union's assessment. Wow. In fact, we know that trillions of rands has been stolen by the ANC government. I call them the cancer government. You know, small c, capital ANC, small ER. And so I'll always write ANC that way because my wife's been battling cancer for 10 years. I know what cancer is. A cancer is a cell that doesn't contribute to the health of the body, but it breaks down the health of the body. And that's what the ANC are. They don't contribute one darn good thing. All they do is contribute disease. So if you think of a tick, and we've got to pull ticks off ourselves whenever we go into the bush. And that was a normal thing in Rhodesia. I had tick bite fever up at the border. A tick doesn't contribute anything to your body except disease. It lives off your blood. It sucks the blood off you. But, you know, a tick will normally, when he's got enough blood, will fall off. But these characters keep leeching. Affirmative action is racism. Racial quotas on sports, education, employment. It is, in fact, the stupidest thing they could do because, first of all, what is the greatest commandment? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength, and you to love your neighbor as yourself. Well, how do I love my neighbor? Well, by obeying the second tablet of the law. Don't steal your neighbor's life. Don't steal your neighbor's wife. Don't steal your neighbor's property. Don't steal your neighbor's good name through gossip, slander, or false witness. And don't even be jealous or envious of your neighbor. Don't covet. Respect the life and property of your neighbor. And Jesus summarized this, the second tablet of the law, by saying, do to others what you want them to do to you. And the fact is, the whole point of black economic empowerment is it hurts the very people they claim to want to help. And plainly, what it does is it's the most destructive thing you could possibly do because it gives a sense of victimhood and entitlement. There's nothing more destructive to any person than an abundance of bread and idleness of hands. And so a sense of entitlement and perpetual victimhood is absolutely devastating to the character and the integrity and the work ethic of people. So socialist welfare programs actually debase the very people they're ostensibly meant to serve and help. Hard work and discipline and integrity are essential for any individual. And to inculcate in any group of people a sense of victimhood and entitlement and grievance destroys them body, mind, and soul. And you can see the evidence in the litter-strewn, graffiti-vandalized, pollution-ridden, broken-down areas that are crime ghettos where large numbers of recipients of government handouts live. So it's an absolute disaster, and I would say that the ANC has destroyed the black people of this country with their affirmative action and their narrative and their racial quotas, and the whole BBBEE is a catastrophe, not only from us who've been stolen from, but to the ones that it's meant to be helping.
Yes, indeed. That's always the great irony for me of the new South Africa, that black people are actually much worse off than they've ever been. They're definitely worse off than at the height of apartheid. We have about 2 or 3 minutes, then we'll go into our first break for tonight. Just 1 or 2 closing remarks for the first part of our show relating to what we spoke about, Peter.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that question. Go ahead. I didn't understand.
It's fine. I just asked you to sum up what you've been saying. Oh. We come very close to the...
Well, it's that we bow before no one but God alone. And we will not bow before any of these BLM crowds, anything like that. We need to know our history. And we need to know the facts. And truth does not fear investigation. And we want to love our neighbor. We don't want to hurt any people. We don't want to defraud any black people. And we think BBBEE is defrauding all black people, because what it's actually doing is, in the name of helping the black people, what they've actually done is defraud them all, not only of the work ethic and hard work that they need to be able to develop in any kind of integrity, but it's also looted from them what is meant to be serving them, because plainly people aren't getting the electricity, they're not getting the education, they're not getting the medical, they're not getting any of the things they're meant to be getting, because the state, in the name of helping black people, is actually looting from the public treasury. And so the very people who this is meant to be in favor of are actually suffering the most, because they're the ones dying in these hospitals which don't have the medicines and which are in a colossal mess and all the rest of it. So, yes, it's a fraud, it's a failure, and it's a farce.
Indeed so. Indeed so. And when you look at the legacy of the man, Nelson Mandela, Saint Mandela, Karen used to call him Saint Mandela every time we did the show on this. This is his legacy. His legacy is Black Lives Matter. His legacy is not even reverse apartheid in South Africa, if we only had reverse apartheid. But truly needs stolen from those people who need it the most. It's actually anti-black. His legacy is the destruction of the black race on earth. That's how I see this. I think we have about 1 minute before we go to break. After the break, we will discuss a host of other issues. And specifically, Peter, you wrote a very interesting piece about how to counter leftist thinking and leftist arguments. I think we really need to discuss that, to empower ourselves, take on this brave new world out there, this new order, this new normal that's being pressured on us. I think it's crucial that we arm ourselves to the teeth, because it's coming, and it's coming with a vengeance at us. And we need to have a look at that. Thank you, folks. We will be back in a couple of minutes. I think we can just about start or hear the music start. We will be back in about 2 or 3 minutes. Thank you very much.
Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
We're anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a civil majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet. Look, you stupid bastard. You've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look. Just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I've seen such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace, and stupidity.
I'll do you for that. What? Come here. What are you going to do, bleed on me? I'm invincible.
You're a loony.
The Black Knight always triumphs.
Roundtable Live, Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Bring your mind, bring your ideas, bring your voice. King Arthur had nothing on us. Here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We've got to stop them! They're going to kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone or human being.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Right, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
All right. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Radio Free South Africa with your host, Colt van Merwe. I'm broadcasting right from the middle of South Africa, literally the middle of South Africa, one of the most central places in the whole of the country, Northern Free State. And I have our esteemed guest, Dr. Peter Hammond from the front, fellowship front, now my tongue is not assisting me. Frontline fellowship, a dear friend of our station, a dear friend of our cause. And before we start off, I did not introduce you properly because I wanted you to come in with impetus in this program, Peter. Now, I always fame myself, and I boast about this, that the people speaking on my show, they are not simple people reading something in the newspaper and just simply coming and regurgitating it on radio. I get people that's the real thing, that was in the front line. The name of your organization already says it. You were in the front line. Peter, give us a little bit of background of who you are, and especially during the time of the Iron Curtain. What is it that you did in Europe and Africa?
Well, I'm 60 years old now. I was born in 1960. I was raised in Rhodesia, Bulawayo, Rhodesia. And what a privilege to have been raised as a young person in a country like Rhodesia, with wild animals just outside the city limits and with such a lot of freedom. And what a magnificent country. I loved Rhodesia. And my father fought in the Second World War all 6 years in the British 8th Army in the Royal Artillery. My mother is German. She is in Berlin suffering multiple thousand bomber raids, having everything around her destroyed. So you can imagine I had an interest in history to find out why were my parents' generation fighting one another when, you know, we've got so much in common. And so, of course, that led me into a lot of history. And why was Britain, whom my dad fought for, betraying as Rhodesia and supporting our enemies at a time when we're fighting communist terrorism. You know, we fought for them while they're not fighting for us. So I had developed an interest in history early on, and I was too young for the Rhodesian War. My brother fought in the Rhodesian War. I served in the South African Defence Force up in Southwest Africa, Angola, and all of that. I was in South African Infantry, and in my national service on my call-ups through the Citizens Force 10 years, I was regularly called up for Citizens Force com ops, chaplain services, and I did meetings in about 1,200 meetings across South Africa, Southwest Africa, the border into Angola with UNITA during the war in the 1980s up there. Well, in the army, I started a Bible study and prayer fellowship. We met every night for Bible study and prayer throughout my 2 years national service, and our group grew, and out of it grew a vision for taking the gospel to our enemies, the communists, Mozambique, Angola, and so on. And at the end of my time in the army, I put everything I had into getting Bibles, Jesus film, getting on a motorbike, heading out across the border to Mozambique, taking the gospel to the communist Frelimo, helping the church that's persecuted there, then into Angola and Zimbabwe and Zambia. And for the last 38 years, it's been a wild adventure of discipleship. By God's grace, I've traveled now in 42 countries, and I've ministered in 38 countries. And that included smuggling behind the Iron Curtain, through the Berlin Wall, Checkpoint Charlie, and all that, everywhere from Poland, East Germany, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Romania, Bulgaria, Albania. So I worked throughout Eastern Europe, smuggling and ministering to churches from one side or the other, underground Bible colleges. And been an extraordinary privilege of mine to see the Berlin Wall collapse, to see the Iron Curtain collapse, to see freedom come to the captive nations that were under the Soviets. And I've worked for the independence of South Sudan, who managed to achieve their independence by 2011, did a lot of work in Sudan. It's been one of my main mission fields over the years. And of course, as I've seen so much of this, I've seen the need to write history books and to expose these things. So it led me to write books like Holocaust in Rwanda, In the Killing Fields of Mozambique, Faith and Defiance Sudan, and then history books, because I thought there's so much distortion of history. So I've written Slavery, Terrorism, Islam, The Historical Roots and Contemporary Threats, and sketches from South African history, because I see a history being attacked, and victorious Christians who changed the world. Greatest Century of Missions, Greatest Century of Reformation, to counter the lies and disinformation and guilt manipulation. I am a father. I've got four children. I've got two grandchildren. And so it has been a major concern in my heart to promote home education, because I've seen the distortions coming on in state schools and the twisting of textbooks. I've started writing my own history books to put the record straight and to be able to counter this and to see my children and grandchildren have access to better sources of information than the indoctrination and propaganda being dished up in the name of education in our schools. And that's also led me on to radio ministries like this. And I praise God for your openness and Radio Free South Africa. We certainly need a free South Africa, and we can be free if we let the truth set us free. And so I'm committed to fighting. I've never stopped fighting the communists when we weren't allowed to fight them on the border anymore. I just continue to fight them through media, through writing, through truth, through preaching, through teaching, through literature, through our newsletters, through articles, through emails. And to me, every single day we're out there to fight communism and to fight for freedom and to fight for Christian civilization and a free Christian South Africa. That's my vision. That's our goal. The kingdom of God on earth. We are not going to bow to the spirit of this world.
Yes, indeed. I've always said it on this show, and everybody knows that I've seen Karen as one of my great mentors and actually like a mother to my soul. And we've always spoken on the show so often about just simply telling the truth. Because if we tell the truth about South Africa, then the truth will set us free. The truth will defend us. We do not have to lie. And that's what makes this it's a calling for me by this time. And it's so nice just simply to bring the truth. Verifiable truth. If Peter Hammond says something, you can go and fact check him. He's right. You will not fault him on his facts. When Skull van Merwe says something, you can go and fact check. You will not catch me out on a fact, because the truth is on our side, and that is what makes this so significant and magnificent, to bring the truth to people, just simply to tell them how it is. Don't look for yourself. I've often spoken to liberal people in Europe and even North America to say to them, I will pay you a plane ticket. Climb on a plane, fly to South Africa, and come and see for yourself what I am speaking about. I do not have to lie. And this is what's so nice and so close to my heart. So thank you very much also for the compliment, Peter. I want you to describe to me, because you did a magnificent piece recently on how to counter the left, how to fight back, to do the right thing, to say the right thing. How do we counter these people coming at us? How do we go about by doing this?
Yes, well, there's nothing communists respect more than strength. There's nothing they despise more than weakness. So those people who think they can calm the situation by bowing to the mob or washing their feet or brushing their boots or kissing their boots, and we're not speaking hypothetically, they're people who have actually done it, not just figuratively, but literally kiss their boots and wash their feet and so on. But they have no idea that what they're actually doing is...
Yes? Yes. Stop there. Ever imagine that in our lives we would actually see what you described? Did you actually think that we will see white people bowing to black people in guilt, kissing their feet? Can you believe this? Sorry that I interjected, but I just had to. Please continue with your narration.
No, it's incredible, because as the Bible says, that for a righteous person to bow before the wicked is like a polluted stream. It's like a corrupted fountain. And in fact, let's make no mistake, Marxist pro-abortion, pro-pornography, pimps, gasoline bomb, firebomb, Molotov cocktail throwing, rock throwing, violent revolutionaries are wicked people by definition. And for people, especially Christians, to bow before them is shocking. I don't have too much of a problem when the wicked are wicked. I mean, I expect communists to be communists and so on. But what I don't expect is to see Christians, Bible-believing, born-again people who claim to fear God, bowing before Marxist, Antichrist pagans. It just doesn't make any sense. So having served the persecuted church, my main work for the last 38 years has been serving persecuted Christians, Christians who have suffered persecution. I'm talking about everywhere from Romania and Poland, through Albania, Sudan, Nigeria, the Congo, Angola, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, ministering to churches where people are literally being persecuted or tortured for their faith. And I've been imprisoned, I've been shot at, and I've been bombed, and I've been waterboarded and tortured in the prisons as well. So I know something about what our friends are suffering at the hands of Marxists. But to bow before the mob or mouth their mantra that they want to do, it's not calming the situation. It's greatly aggravating the situation, because far from calming situation down, they encourage the revolutionaries to demand far, far more and to escalate their most irresponsible demands. And people need to understand that. You can never bow to bullies. They only respect resistance. They despise weakness. And in my experience, it's absolutely essential you never give Marxist bullies or mobs a millimeter. If you give them an inch, they'll take a mile. And I was brought up in war-torn Rhodesia. I've experienced terrorism revolution. I've worked in communist Angola and Mozambique. I've been imprisoned in Zambia and Mozambique. And in many cases, I've seen the more steadfastly and strongly you stand, the better. And the moment Marxists sense weakness or fear or compromise, it's like sharks smelling blood. They'll only howl for more and escalate the unreasonable demands. And so to me, I can give an example that when I was a prisoner, I was locked up in Zimbabwe, and I was dragged off into it was actually 3rd Brigade headquarters in Mutare, what used to be Umtali in the Vumba, just about in the Mozambique border. And CIO is no joke, Central Intelligence Organization. And these CIO are brutal, and the atrocities, the tortures they do are terrible. So you can imagine, I'm dragged into this room, and in the room I immediately see it looks like a hardware store. They have armchair with leather straps for the legs and for the arms. This is not a good sign. And you could see the batteries with like car batteries with crocodile clips and wires. Obviously, they weren't going to depend on the electricity, which would often go out if they wanted to charge you. You'd only be charged with electricity. There were all kinds of what looked like hardware tools on the table. This is a torture chamber. I come in there, and the first thing they said, now, I'd been captured after having done evangelistic outreach in a ZANU army base, so you can imagine they were not very happy with me. What had happened was one of these chaps had stood up and said, Mugabe is my God. A war of liberation is my Bible. ZANU is my church. We are the master of our own destinies. And I turned to him and I said, you know, Mugabe's just a man. He's going to die one day. ZANU, it's a political party. It's up, down. You used to call ZAPU your comrades. What are they now? No, they're lackeys of the running dogs. They're fascists. Right, exactly. I said, parties come and go. And he said, a war of liberation is my Bible. I said, but there's no atonement in the war of liberation. I was speaking like this. Well, somebody slunk off and got on the radio and called CIO, and CIO set up an ambush. And so I was captured in a way out of this base and dragged off to the CIO interrogation room. Now you can imagine I'm being pulled into this. I'm talking about 1984. This is a bad situation, and I know what happens in these places. And all I could think was what Reverend Roger Vokert said. Every time you preach, preach like a dying man to dying men, like it's the last chance you'll have to speak, and like the last chance they may have to hear. And so I, when they said, what are you teaching them in? I just started to preach the gospel, the holiness of God, the depravity of man, the wrath of God, eternal judgment, point on a man once and after judgment. And they started, no, stop, stop, stop. Why have you come to Zimbabwe? So I gave my testimony of how God had converted me. And while I was talking, this, I don't want to minimize or make a joke out of something very serious, because the CIO are deadly serious. I mean, they murder and torture a lot of people to this day. But the fact is, while I was speaking, and I did not think I would get out of there alive, honestly, but while I was speaking to him, conviction of sin came on him. And I saw these men who had been so threatening and so overpowering just a few moments ago suddenly start to scratch the back of their heads and saying things like, my mother's religious, my sister's a Christian. And you could see they were absolutely deflated. And Suvar, within an hour, they were waving goodbye to me as I drove out of 3rd Brigade headquarters in Matari, holding the Bibles I'd just given them and literally waving us goodbye. Extraordinary. Now, I mean, that's God, but I didn't know this would get us out of it. But I just thought, if I'm going down, I'm going to go down preaching the gospel, making a stand. And God was merciful. And whatever he did something miraculous, because we got out there with our fingernails intact and without being electrocuted and tortured. Now, I've had torture scenes at other occasions, like in Mozambique in 1989. But this is 1984 in Zimbabwe. And I found when I stand up, I've stood up in communist bases and I've been in terrorist camps. And I've preached the gospel to enemies, and I've shown the Jesus film, and I've preached the gospel to these people and handed out Bibles. And I find that even though these people are Marxist terrorists, when you're strong and when you're stable and we stand firm and when you're definite, they respect that. Just like when Mandela asked, what were you doing in the years of struggle? And I tell them straight, fighting people like you. They respect it when you're straight. They despise you when you're weak. And so I'm absolutely convinced that we cannot bow to the mob. And when people think that you can reason with a mob, they don't understand that all they're doing is inciting them to escalate the demands and getting them more and more feverish. And you've seen it. If you've watched these films of what happens in these riots and with the BLM and so on, we could give you all kinds of examples of mayors and governors and police chiefs in Minnesota who have bowed before the mob, and in New York, who didn't get respect. They were then booed and jeered and so on as they left after having bowed and put the clenched fist and apologized to the mob and all this. They were the same people, you'll see them just a short while afterwards, with blood streaming from the heads. They've been hit over the head with baseball bats and things like this by the very mob they've been trying to appease. This is how it works. This is the revolution. There's nothing they despise more than weakness. There's nothing they respect more than strength.
Exactly. Exactly. And we need to be steadfast throughout. I always speak to my people in the National Conservative Party also to say that if they come for you, and even if the enemies from within, if they come for you, fight back. Just simply stand your ground, fight back. Because so often in my life, I've seen that the moment that you start giving, they simply become stronger and more aggressively. I can underline what you said. At one point in time, I ended up in a holding cell for whatever reason. We don't have to discuss it here. And yes, I was basically the only white man between, like, if I remember correctly, between 15 to 20 black people in that cell, black men in that cell. And yes, we started to speak about religion at some point. And by the end of that evening, we were holding a church mass. Definitely. Christianity, definitely. But religion, spirituality, all these aspects, definitely counter the demon. Because this is demons. We are taught by the Christian Bible that we are not fighting against flesh and blood. We're fighting against evil spirits, evil demons. It's to counter that demon that we need to do what you so eloquently described to do. That's really my opinion of this whole thing. We literally fighting evil. This is what we are doing. Peter?
Yes. Be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Stand therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on a breastplate of righteousness, having shod your feet to the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, taking up the shield of faith, with which you'll be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one, and take up the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, praying always with all prayer and supplication of Spirit, being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints. That's Ephesians 6. And notice the very first weapon, the first piece of armor that you to put on is the belt of truth. Truth is the first part of the armor of God. And so what we're doing in trying to speak the truth is the first part of spiritual warfare. This is spiritual warfare. And I've sensed it frequently. My younger daughter, who's an artist, we homeschooled her. She did not, we wouldn't send any of our children to UCT, but because she's in ballroom dancing, she had reason to be up at University of Cape Town back in 2015 when the Rhodes Must Fall riots broke out. And she was there that night, but they started to come into the halls and pull off these priceless, original oil on canvas paintings, and tear them down and set them alight. And my daughter physically resisted and pushed them out. And I was brave, proud of her bravery, but of course I could fear for my daughter when she told me, and she said, "Dad, they look like they hated me." I said, "They do." She said, they look like they want to kill me. I said, "I'm sure they did." And she said, "They seem demon-possessed." And I said, "Yes, they are." And this is what we're dealing with. And I've seen it, and you've seen it. You're dealing with spiritual wickedness and evil. And some people have described communism as fire in the minds of men. And others have described it as a time of madness. And the Bible speaks in Ecclesiastes of there being madness in the hearts of men. And in fact, I think we're seeing all of this in Marxism. Communism is satanic. And you can see it not just by the fruit, but the root, because Karl Marx was a Satanist. It's been well documented by Richard Wurmbrand in his book, Marx and Satan. And Karl Marx's hatred for God drove it all. And Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the greatest Russian author of the 20th century, said that Antichrist malice is not a mere side effect of Marxism. It's the central pivot. It's the heart and soul of Marxism. Said the economic pretensions are secondary. The heart and soul of Marxism, communism, is hatred for God. And in fact, Vladimir Lenin said, "We fight against God to snatch believers from him." This is at the heart and soul of what you're dealing with. And what we're seeing in the streets of America, and what we've been seeing for a long time in the streets in South Africa, is satanic, demonic, it's evil. And so when facing it, we need to realize we've got to deal with the spiritual. Submit to God. Resist the devil. He will flee from you. Greater is Christ in you than him who's in the world. We can be more than conquerors through Christ who loved us. We need to understand spiritual warfare. We need to understand our spiritual armor. We need to be strong in God. We need to persevere. And I'm inspired by the Christians in Eastern Europe who stood for decades against atheism when they were trying to destroy the people in Russia, and yet the Christians stood firm. And we need to have the same sense of confidence here in South Africa that despite how evil and how powerful they seem right now, they will fall. Every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, the glory of God the Father. And one of the great inspiring examples for this for me is in Moscow. There is the Church of Christ the Savior Cathedral. It's the largest church in Russia. When it was built, it was the third largest church in the world. It was built to celebrate the defeat of the French Revolutionary Forces in 1812. You know, the 1812 overture was actually premiered in the Christ the Savior Cathedral at its inauguration. And the church has stood from the late 1800s all the way through till 1931. 1931, it was dynamited and destroyed by order of Vladimir Lenin. Vladimir Lenin had this filmed, and the word went out worldwide, this is a symbol of the defeat of faith and a triumph of atheism in Russia. 1931, 5th of December, 1931. Well, he planned to build a kind of Tower of Babel, Palace of the Soviets over it, in a sort of Tower of Babel buttress style with an idol of Lenin on the very top with his fist shaking in God's face. That was what he wanted to put on the very site where this wonderful Church of Christ the Savior Cathedral had stood. Well, for different reasons, that was never done. And in 1990, the church received permission from Boris Yeltsin after he ousted Gorbachev to rebuild the Church of Christ the Savior. And by the year 2000, they'd completed. They did it in just 10 years, all with private donations from poor people. About 1 million Russians contributed personally. They had no state help. They rebuilt the church to the original specs on the exact location, and it's a magnificent church. And the Church of Christ the Savior Cathedral's first order of business was to have a service, a consecrated chapel for the memory of the Russian Tsar Nicholas II and his lovely family who were murdered by the Bolsheviks 18 July in 1918. Interestingly, just the day before Nelson Mandela was born. And this brutal murder of the Russian royal family was their first concern, to put that right. Well, today in Moscow, there's 500 new churches being built. 80% of the population of Russia are baptized Christians and who claim to be members of the Orthodox Church of Russia. And then there's many other denominations there too. Atheism has failed and faith has triumphed in Russia. After 70 years of Bolshevik malice and Marxist persecution, the church in Russia is strong and atheism is in disgrace there. And the government has gotten rid of the commissars, and they've brought in the chaplains, and they're printing Bibles. The government's printing Bibles. We used to smuggle Bibles in there. Now they're printing Bibles to put in hotel rooms. They've got laws against the same homosexual perversion, abortion, pornography, and other legislation we've got legalized here. Russia's fighting against the very evils the ANC is promoting here. It's an extraordinary thing to me. For most of my life, the Russians have been our enemies, and yet now Russia's our allies, and it's one of the strongest countries in Europe. Today, there's more Bible-believing, born-again Christians in Russia than any other country in Europe. And that, to me, is just an example. It doesn't matter what the Marxists do, they will lose. I mean, as you said, they cannot succeed the way they promote abortion, all this. They actually are destroying their own descendants, and they're undermining their own futures.
Is that a fact? The resurgence of the Orthodox Church in Eastern Europe, not only even in Russia, the whole of Eastern Europe, Serbia. One of my close friends happened to be the chief minister to the Crown Prince of Serbia, and it's their absolute duty and privilege at this point in time to bring back the Orthodox Church to Serbia. Now, Serbia, for very long, being one of the beacons of communism. And they've turned totally around, obviously. Russia also, totally around. Where the Orthodox Church is today stronger, I think, than it's ever been. The time of the Tsars. The Orthodox Church is extremely strong, even financially. They're extremely, it's an extremely rich church. And what's notable to me about the Orthodox Church is that they are definitely returning to their roots and their Christian roots, not necessarily their traditional roots, their Christian, the pure Christian faith. You can see it in the writings of some of their patriarchs and so forth. So it's a very interesting resurgence of Christianity in that area. Maybe at one point we will see it in Western Europe. I see something else happening in Western and especially Northern Europe, where Germanic heathenism is coming very strongly. I think many of the people in those areas just simply abandoned Christianity because of the failure of the church. If you look at the church in Sweden, for instance, it became so corrupted that people simply turned their back on Christianity because it was the church. They are going back to Germanic heathenism. But at least we're moving into the direction where atheism and communism is being defeated by religion. Whether it be Christian, whether it be Orthodox, whether it be Germanic heathenism, it's a very interesting trend that's happening in Europe at this point.
Yes, in fact, if you look at Europe today, it's quite clear that the strongest churches, the strongest faith, the brightest light spiritually on Eastern Europe, behind what used to be the Iron Curtain, the largest number of Christians in Europe is in Russia, the second largest Ukraine, the third largest Romania, and they all have this in common, they're all behind the what used to be the Iron Curtain. So it would seem that the violent persecution by communism and the indoctrination by Marxism was less effective, ultimately, in destroying the church. In fact, counterproductive is more accurate, than was the Hollywood seduction and materialism and secular humanism of Western Europe. So Western Europe and America are spiritually weaker. And again, this is an important spiritual point. Out of hard times comes strong faith. But strong faith often makes good times and healthy societies. But the trouble is healthy societies can breed soft grandchildren who don't appreciate what they've come from. And that leads to bad times. Now, if you just think of how the Afrikaans people were made so strong by the tough experience and rigors of the Great Trek and all that they had to go through. But at a certain point, maybe they had gotten a bit comfortable, and along came the Anglo-Boer War. And out of that came the most dynamic, strong, tough people. And we think of the Delarays and the De Wets and the phenomenal strength. And now, after that, there was a lot of strength and power and energy, but it seemed that the grandchildren and great-grandchildren had gotten soft and weak. And now you see the result. And so we need a new going back to our roots and our faith. And in many ways, it's the tough times that make us better and stronger. So, for example, I was brought up in affluence in Rhodesia. We had four servants. I didn't have to make my bed or brush my shoes and so on. But when I went to the South African Army, they put you under pressure and, we had to have everything shining. And when I think of what we were able to do in the Army, the training and discipline, and that made sure that at least all of the men in South Africa had an experience that taught them some discipline and a hard work and those who had border duty danger as well. And out of that came good things. But look at what's happened to the soft characters who don't know what conscription is, don't know what a border war is, who don't have any of the disciplines we had. They don't even have the Bible education in schools that we were having. And you can see the results. And it's pitiful and it's shocking. And we need a rebirth of faith and freedom. And it's going to come out of hard times. And this is what we learned from Eastern Europe. The church under persecution will never be destroyed. It will never die. It will only become stronger. And this is something the communists do not seem to understand. The more they persecute the church, the stronger they make the church. And the church ultimately will defeat them. I mean, we will see the complete and utter destruction of communism, just as we've seen in every place. They try, they seem to succeed for a time, but their evil will destroy the wicked. They have the seeds of destruction within themselves. And there's a lovely picture of this also in the Lubyanka in Moscow, outside the Lubyanka, which was the headquarters for the KGB. If you heard someone say they've been called to the Lubyanka, or you heard you've been summoned to the Lubyanka, your blood would run cold. Everyone in Russia knew the Lubyanka's KGB headquarters, and thousands, tens of thousands of Christians were imprisoned, tortured, murdered there. It was a place of terror. Well, outside the Lubyanka was a huge statue, massive statue, about 90 feet high, of Dzerzhinsky, Felix Dzerzhinsky, this Marxist who founded the Cheka, which became the NKVD, which became the KGB. Well, in 1991, the people in Moscow came and toppled the statue of Dzerzhinsky. And they celebrated as they got rid of Dzerzhinsky and Marx and Lenin statues, tens of thousands from all over. It seemed every village had something like that of Lenin and Marx and so on. Well, it all went. Something like 28,000 statues of Marxist idols were toppled in the space of a few years. Well, if you go back to the Lubyanka Square now, there's no longer any statue in the middle. But in the park just across the road is a stone. Not just any stone. It's a stone from Solovetsky Island. Now, Solovetsky Island's up in the White Sea. It's up in the Arctic Circle. It was a monastery in the most remote place imaginable. And the communists took over this Solovetsky Monastery on Solovetsky Island in the White Sea and turned the first prototype concentration camp. In that Solovetsky concentration camp, they killed 95,000 ministers of the gospel. 95,000 just in that one concentration camp. And they've brought from that monastery, that concentration camp, a stone, a large stone, and they've put it in the park just facing the Lubyanka. And you know the symbolism. Anyone who's read Daniel in the Bible immediately recognizes the symbolism of the statue and the stone. Well, as Daniel saw that a statue symbolizing all the empires of the world, the head of gold, the chest of silver, the stomach of bronze, the legs of iron, the feet of iron and clay. And along comes a stone that strikes the statue and it crumbles to dust. And the wind blows the dust away and the stone grows to be a mountain that fills the whole earth. And Jesus said that he is the cornerstone. And this cornerstone, which the builders rejected as worthless, has become the chief stone of all. And Jesus said, if anyone falls on this stone, he will be cut to pieces. But if this stone falls on someone, it will crush him to dust. And this is repeated in several of the Gospels. And Jesus is the cornerstone. And if anyone falls on Christ, if anyone tries to persecute or destroy the church, he will be cut to pieces. And when Christ's day of judgment comes, he'll crush them to dust. And you see a picture of this in Lubyanka Square outside the old KGB headquarters in Lubyanka. The statue is gone and the stone remains. And this should just remind us of the fact that victory is assured. These atheists who decide to fight against God will lose.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And I wanted to ask you about the gulags, because we always conjure up this image of Soviet Russia, and we can't think or not think about the gulags. In other words, those concentration camps, you call it exactly what it is. They were massive. We're speaking of millions upon millions of people that were affected, either being held in gulags or their families affected by those things. Don't you think that also had an effect that it caused blowback into communism in Russia? That people just simply came to a point that they couldn't take it anymore. And that is why the whole system started to crumble. Don't you think that the gulags, once again, the revolution eating itself, don't you think the gulags had a tremendous important effect to that?
Yeah, no, it was hideous. Just so people understand what we're talking about, the gulag, which stood for, in Russian acronym, Main Administration Workers' Camp. So, gulag. And it was Alexander Solzhenitsyn who gave us the word, the gulag, which described this archipelago of camps. Now, just in case you don't understand the numbers, 1,976 concentration camps, plus, and most of those in the Arctic hellholes of Siberia, 273 prisons, 85 psychiatric prisons, which included especially ministers of the gospel, where instead of arresting for being ministers, they said they had a psychiatric problem because they didn't believe in scientific socialism or they didn't believe in evolution or something, and so they locked them up in a padded cell with literally in these straitjackets and shoved drugs into them, and 41 death camps. So the Gulag Archipelago incarcerated 55 million people in the days of Stalin, and they were used to build whole canals just with human power using wheelbarrows and spades. They did vast projects all over the place, massive industrialization projects, dams and so on. So 55 million people were chewed up by the gulags in the days of Stalin. But even under Gorbachev, Glasnost, Perestroika, Gorbachev, there were only 5 million political and religious prisoners, of which a million were religious prisoners. That's under Gorbachev, who's meant to be a good guy. So Joseph Stalin once said, the death of one person is a tragedy, but the death of a million is just a statistic. And that's the mentality of the Marxists. They didn't care about the millions of lives they chewed up in these Arctic hellholes. And to try and understand what we're talking about, Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote the book The Gulag Archipelago and One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, which, by the way, now are set with books at school. When I was at school in Rhodesia, we had George Orwell's 1984 and Animal Farm as set with books, which was very good. But in Russia, there's four books written by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, which includes The Gulag Archipelago and One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. And at the end of this one day of grueling suffering of Ivan Denisovich, it says, this was just one day in life, Ivan Denisovich. There were, and it gives how many thousands of others. And the man who wrote it, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, was an artillery officer, a captain in the Red Army, who was sentenced to 8 years in prison for making a comment which could be construed as critical of the leader, Joseph Stalin. And he went to the Gulag for 8 years as a slave in the Arctic hellholes in Siberia. So, yes. This is some of what the people suffered in Russia, and we need to just understand this is the mentality of communism. They had Cabo Delgado, Mozambique D, as they called it, concentration camps, re-education camps in Mozambique. I documented at least 300,000 people were chewed up into the concentration camps of Mozambique. There were at least 80,000 public executions in the first 2 years of Samora Machel's reign in Mozambique, and millions died in a man-made famine there. So that's Mozambique. They were also having these camps in Angola. In fact, I've spoken to, have had supper with eight people who at one time who were in the concentration camps in Angola. And one of these people, now I'm talking about black Angolans telling me what they suffered at the hands of the communists in Angola, and this included Cubans running these camps. They said at one point we'd suffered so much and it was just so inhumane what they were putting us through that one of us cried out, why don't you just kill us and get it over with? And the Cuban responded, oh no, we don't want to kill you. We don't want to send you to heaven with God. No, we want you to curse Christ and come to hell with us for all eternity. Now that gives you an insight into the heart and soul of communism.
It's satanic by its very nature. That the whole New World Order is satanic in its very nature. It seeks to overturn everything, because the word Satan actually means exactly that. It overturns the natural into the unnatural. That's what communism, that is what Marxism is. It overturns everything that's natural. Look at the whole issue of transgenderism. It turns a man into a woman. Now, how basic can that be? We've often on the show spoke about children being confused as to their gender. What's more easy to distinguish as a physical feature that makes one person a man or a boy and the other a girl? But now you confuse that child's hair to such an extent that they do not even know that most basic of what nature made them. So yes, it, by its very nature, it's satanic. It's overturning the natural to the unnatural.
Yeah, Peter? It is. In fact, Karl Marx said new gods need to be installed. And this is what's behind the pulling down of monuments and statues. They want to remove the heroes of a culture or a community or a nation. And they want to replace them with their heroes, fake heroes. And so, you know, instead of George Washington in America or Christopher Columbus or Robert E. Lee or any of these heroes of America, they now want to put up statues to George Floyd, for example, who was overdosing on drugs while resisting arrest after having a long sheet of crimes, including violent crimes, against him. So I don't know if he changed much before he died, but he was certainly on drugs, multiple drugs, at the very time he was resisting arrest and tragically died. But it doesn't matter about the facts. They make new gods and they lift up. Do you know, one of the youngsters, they've built a monument to in the Soviet Union, which in fact, they built many monuments to him and songs to him and all this. He was a young boy. I think he was 12 or 13 years old. And I've seen his statue, the red scarf and all that. He is a hero. He was a hero of the Soviet Union because he reported his parents. His parents were Bible-believing Christians. He reported that his parents were trying to teach the Bible to him, and his parents were shot. And he received an Order of Lenin, and he was lifted up, and they took him all around the country. And he was a hero because he was willing to betray his own parents. And so they lifted up this youngster. I've just forgotten his name for a moment. Very famous in Soviet Union. And this is the kind of example. They lift up a Che Guevara, who boasted that he killed over 4,000 people personally. Not just by orders. He personally killed men, women, children. And he boasted, hey, he even killed children and women, yeah, and 13-year-olds and so on. And there's youngsters, they're wearing Che Guevara T-shirts. They don't know what a dirty, unwashed, mass-murdering thug Che Guevara was. And so it goes on. They lift up, whether it's Samora Michel, who murdered his first wife, who murdered his third wife's first baby because he didn't think he was the father, man who probably murdered the founder of Lima too, Eduardo Malagi. He's the hero. And so it goes on. The Marxist will lift up fake heroes. And this is, I'm slightly diverging here, but I'm concerned the way our Hollywood keeps pushing fake heroes. And the worst of these to me are the superheroes. Because you know that these superheroes are fake. Obviously, I mean, there's no such thing as Spider-Man, Superman, and Iron Man, and all these other blasted things. But we've got real heroes. I mean, David in the Bible, Delray, DeVette. We've got the real, genuine heroes. And in Rhodesia, we had Alan Wilson and others like this. Why do we need to have these fake heroes who are not real? They defy the laws of gravity and common sense. And yet Hollywood wants to take from you the real. They want to take you away from God and the Bible and the church and your history and your culture and your nation and your race. And they want to give you a whole lot of fake things. They give you fake food. They give you fake genders. They give you fake everything. And this is why our society today is so angry with the truth. You and I have been sworn at because we've told people the truth. Because people today love the lie and they would prefer to be deceived than to have someone tell them the truth.
Yes, they are more comfortable with truth because it's nicer. It feels better to believe in all the mumble and jumble. If we look at COVID, we have about 10 minutes left. If we look at COVID, for instance, I have my own views on this whole pandemic, epidemic. Yes, there's a virus. There's a strange virus going around. I happen to have spoken to a guest two or three shows back, which actually enlightened me as to two or three years back, the so-called vape disease. Do you remember that still, Peter? The vape disease, when you vape, it's that thing. It's like smoking.
Oh, yes. Vaping, yes. Mm-hmm.
Some people were diagnosed with that in the United States, and it was a big boo at that point in time, and then all of a sudden it died down. Now, that was apparently COVID's predecessor, ancestor, whatever you call it. Huh. That was what the vape disease was. Now, If you look at the whole issue of COVID, for instance, and how quickly people bought into this whole thing of COVID and sitting literally scared in their houses, not willing to go outside, even after the High Court in Pretoria goes in the LFN case and says, but it's unconstitutional. People are not even at the point where they realize that they have rights that the court just reconfirmed and said, just go and take back your lives. It was an eye-opener, but it was extremely scary to me how quickly people fell for this and how unwilling they are today to come out of lockdown, to come out of just simply being deceived around COVID. What's your views on this, Peter?
Yes, God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. And the amount of people living in fear right now, I'm astounded. You expect communists to lie. You expect politicians to lie. What I don't expect is Christians to suddenly give up their discernment. Who would have believed that hundreds of thousands of churches around the world would be closed on Easter. Insane. My friends behind the Iron Curtain who went through all that, they said, this is worse than the days of the dark days under the communists, because people voluntarily not attending church, not even underground church, not even secret services, not even house fellowships. This is unheard of. What is the matter with the people in the West? No law is valid unless it is in accordance with the Bill of Rights. And so our Bill of Rights is very clear. Freedom of conscience, freedom of worship, freedom of religion, freedom of movement, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of association. Any law that infringes these freedoms is no law at all, and it's invalid and it's unconstitutional. This has been true from the days of Magna Carta. This is from the English Bill of Rights of 1689, from all of the statutes through history, from the scripture itself. Do not follow a multitude when they are wrong. We must obey God rather than man. I mean, how much clearer can it be that what we're facing right now is Marxism? I see it. It's exactly, the lockdown is exactly what the Marxist agenda is. And what is a Marxist agenda? You need permission from the state to do everything. The government tells you who can work, when they can work, where they can work, how they can work, who can work with them, and show me your papers, your travel documents. You need permission even to travel in your own city, and they can give you curfews. This is straight out of the Politburo of the Soviet Union's playbook. And for people to accept this in the name of fighting a disease, never in the history of the world have you needed to quarantine the healthy. You quarantine the sick or the vulnerable. You never quarantine the healthy. This is some people call it economic suicide, but suicide suggests that the victim wants to die. This is economic murder. They're killing the businesses of so many people. In fact, millions of people's jobs are being killed worldwide and in our country, not by COVID, but by lockdown. This is a lockdown crisis, not a COVID crisis, because we've had diseases before. I was brought up in Rhodesia where we would test regularly for bilharzia, because you'd get bilharzia for swimming in the dams and so on, yes, and we were checked for tick bite fever, and I got tick bite fever, and I got malaria, and it didn't stop us living. Yes, we got all these different diseases, but I'm still alive. We survived it, and that's how – in Africa, we're not a bunch of sissies, and it's bad enough that the Americans are locking themselves up because of a flu, but South Africans, this is ridiculous. Since when are we afraid of the flu? This is insane. No government's got the right to do this sort of thing to us, and – considering the Supreme Court has come up with what everyone knows, it's unconstitutional, illegal. Where's the backbone? Why are our leaders not standing up and saying this is unconstitutional, this is illegal? And how is it the churches are allowing Marxists to tell you to close your church? They have no right to do that. This isn't that God has told us to close the church. What you're seeing here is a bunch of cowards. Cowards, and it's bad enough that so many Christian leaders are AWOL and deserting, but some have gone to the other side and are bowing to the enemy and have even joined the other side, and that's treason. So right now, the only good thing I can say about all this, aside from a re-emphasis on hygiene, is that it's showing us who are the real leaders and who are the cowards and traitors.
Oh, yes, and also in the political sphere, I took a little bit of flak, but you know me, I always speak my mind and I write my things on my social media. And I pointed out that the controlled opposition parties, and let's not call names, but in South Africa, the so-called opposition parties were actually part of this whole thing. Yes, now they are standing on their own feet and taking cases to the Constitutional Court, very fully knowing They can't go to the Constitutional Court. There's a pending case at the High Court. But yes, even the opposition parties, even the churches, not only bought into this, but actually promoted it and made us to believe that we need to comply with this. We need to bend the knee and go down before this. It's horrific, but it definitely was an eye-opener for me, and it draws those lines that we needed to be drawn, so that we know who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. today we know that. We don't have any doubts left. So, yes, maybe it was a very good thing that happened. I think there's going to be a COVID too. It's not going to be called COVID. It's going to be some other virus. I have my own view on the issue of vaccines, why that is happening. It's a very strange thing that's happening to us, but it's also not really unfamiliar because we know how these people operate. By now we know what their agenda is. So we can actually prepare ourselves. We have a couple of minutes left. Peter, we started off with Nelson Mandela, Saint Nelson Mandela, the false saint, bringing the dark light to earth. And we ended where we say to one another, the truth is what is going to really set us free. The truth is what's going to make us strong. Closing remark, end of the show. What can the listeners take with them? And then obviously, where can they find you so that you can enlighten them even further?
Thank you. We're plainly involved in a world war. We're involved in a world war of worldviews. This is spiritual warfare. It's psychological warfare. And the whole purpose of psychological warfare is to be able to break down the morale of the targeted enemy, which is us, and to be able to undermine our belief system, our value system, our emotions, our motives, our reasoning, our behavior. And so there's so many things involved in psyops. And honestly, everything that we're seeing right now from the news media all the way through the COVID-19 lockdown business, it's all psychological warfare, and it's subverting our society. It's undermining our churches. It's causing havoc amongst the businesses. And of course, the whole goal is to bring about a second phase of the revolution. First phase is political control. Second phase is gaining control of the economy, the churches, the culture. And right now, we've allowed the government to have unprecedented interference in our society. So we've got to resist. And it's absolutely essential that we learn to discern. We need to understand the antidote to psyops, gaslighting, guilt manipulation, Stockholm syndrome, this cultural Marxism, this indoctrination. And if people want to visit on my website, it's frontlinemissionsa.org, frontlinemissionsa for South Africa.org. And my email is peter@frontline.org.za. You can get hold of our mission@frontline.org.za. I'm on Facebook, Peter Hammond. You'll find Frontline Fellowship on Facebook. And we are regularly at our Reformation Studies dealing with issues like psychological warfare, resisting revolution, how to resist Marxist bullying tactics. I'm doing case studies on the Bolshevik Revolution and the French Revolution, so on right now. And because I understand revolutions, and I think most people today don't understand the revolutions, because there's a generation that has grown up since the Berlin Wall came down and since the end of the Cold War. So it's so vital that we explain these things. So if people want to get hold of me, just email mission@frontline.org.za to get on a mailing list, or visit frontlinemissionsa.org.
Thank you so much, Peter. Thank you for the time and all this incredible information that you share with us. Your grasp on what is going on, it's always, I'm sitting here with goosebumps, because it's so enlightening. It's so clear, and it's so direct. What you say to me and listeners. So thank you so much for all this and for your time that you sacrificed for us. And my regards to your family. You're a very close family man. Thank them for the 2 hours that you could give us, and maybe not be with them. It's now evening in South Africa, so obviously you would have been with them. So thank you so much.
It's a great privilege. Thank you so much. We praise God for you. We praise God for Radio Free South Africa, for Revolution Radio. Thank you to Corin. Thank you, Scott. Thank you both behind the scenes. And let's keep fighting the good fight. Let's keep playing our country.
Thank you for listening to Revolution